Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
And I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
I'm the host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.
I'm the diversity fellow, Mallory Begay.
Well, we'll be checking in soon with Mallory and Brian about stories they've been working on this week. But first, Ani, it's been another interesting week of news here in Oregon and around the world. What are some stories that stood out for you this week?
So earlier this week, Governor Kate Brown signed legislation to alter sentencing requirements for young offenders. These are kids under the age of 18, which advocates are calling the most significant reform to hit the state's juvenile justice system in a quarter century. The law reverses some tough-on-crime sentencing rules that were adopted back in 1994, and it means now a judge can decide if a juvenile 15 years of age and older should be tried as an adult for serious crimes like murder and kidnapping. Many state leaders gave credit for this to State Senator Jackie Winters, a Republican from Salem. She was able to rally the Republican support for this measure. She died in May after a two-year-long battle with lung cancer, and her death came 1 week after the legislature had passed the sentencing reform bill. Governor Brown actually offered to sign the bill at her bedside. But Senator Winters said that she wanted the bill to be signed around the people that it was going to affect the most, so that's why they ended up waiting until now to sign it. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert headed out to Green Hill Humane Society this week. We got a really sound-rich story with a lot of dogs barking in the background, and as someone who adopted a rescue dog, I really appreciated hearing that. They added over 11,000 square feet of climate-controlled dog kennels. The facility is now open. First Avenue Shelter, where the dogs were previously housed, is closed. This took years of fundraising and months of construction, and now Green Hill has all their facilities under one roof.
A $5 million price tag, right?
Exactly. Very expensive. Lots of community support. And, you know, adopt, don't shop.
Lots of happy dogs and cats.
Exactly. And if you bring that rescue dog to the beach, make sure you bring a plastic bag, because there was a study that KLCC's Amy Brenneman did a story about just this week that Oregon's coastal waters, not all but some, are polluted with fecal matter, which can sicken swimmers. And not that there are that many swimmers in the Pacific Ocean, but we need to be more careful. A nonprofit group, Environment Oregon Research and Policy Center, found 18 of the sample sites it tested indicated potentially unsafe levels of fecal matter for at least one day. The highest percentage was found in Coos County, where the average beach was potentially unsafe on 25% of the days sampling took place. Though the fecal matter exceeds the EPA's threshold, Oregon has different standards, and the beaches remain open for now. But pick up after your dogs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mallory, you've been covering an evolving issue that the Eugene City Council grappled with this week. Can you give us an update?
Yeah, so this whole thing started Monday morning at a press conference where both Mayor Lucy Vinnis and Councillor Emily Semple voiced their support for a resolution that the resolution condemns white nationalism and alt-right groups and activities. So at the press conference, there were several different leaders from the Latinx Alliance of Lane County, the Jewish Relations Council, and the Eugene Springfield NAACP. And the Human Rights Commission, which Councillor Emily Semple is a member of. But later that day at a city council work session, they put that to a vote, and Emily Semple voted against it. And so one of the reasons why she voted against it, though, was because Councillor Mike Clark was concerned that with the possibility of infringing upon the freedom of speech, because in the resolution it does bring up does bring up white nationalism as a belief, and Mike Clark wasn't comfortable with that language. And while he was making his remarks on the idea of the belief, you could see Emily Semple was just, she was growing more and more uncomfortable with this resolution. Mm-hmm. And if you watch the city council during their final vote, she kind of was just torn between voting for something that she earlier that day was super proud of and supportive of, but she just couldn't vote yes, or she just couldn't vote in favor of it.
I have no problem or difficulty disapproving of white nationalism actions, leaving all free to think and believe whatever we want.
What was the reaction in the room after she made her no vote?
There wasn't really any reaction. I don't think there was. It was just kind of something that actually they tried to move really fast on it. So it's good that you brought that up, because there were a couple instances where Mike Clark and Emily Semple tried to amend the resolution that night. But the mayor, Mayor Vinnis, who also was in support of this resolution, and she was at the press conference earlier that morning, she wanted a vote that night. She brought up that if they didn't vote on this, this was something that would have to be tabled, and they wouldn't, which is kind of funny, but they wouldn't be able to vote on this resolution again until Wednesday. But it got brought back on Wednesday again, after 2 days after 2 days after it got passed. It was brought back to the table by Councillor Chris Pryor, who wanted a more unanimous vote. And that kind of came out because after the reporting of this resolution narrowly passing 4-3, there was a lot of pushback on social media. People were kind of uncomfortable with the fact that it wasn't a unanimous vote. But also because Emily Semple, who introduced it, who's also a member of the Human Rights Council, voted against it. So Chris Pryor brought it back to the table, and for, I think, about 20 minutes, they debated over, like, the language and what to change. And Mike Clark said that since his vote, he's been called a racist on social media.
And I find that really unfortunate, because my objection to this was principled. And I don't personally have a belief that any particular race is more superior or inferior to any other.
So it sounds like they had to sort of sit there together at the meeting and kind of go over the language together in what sounded like it was sort of a tedious process of kind of this word, that word.
Yeah. I think notably there was a moment when they were talking about the language of political dialogue and how that's used in the resolution. And there's a moment where they're around the table debating over how to use that. And then you can hear Betty Taylor in the background just saying, this is ridiculous. Like, why are we doing it this way? She was also an interesting person to watch during this whole thing, because at the initial vote, she didn't vote no because of Mike Clark. She voted no because she felt like there are already legal protections around hate crimes and bias. So that was the reasoning for her no vote. And this time around, she was hesitant to vote yes because she thought it would make more sense to actually sit down and go through the language in a more deliberative way, rather than, you know, talking across the table, trying to figure out, like, what word works best. But because it was a motion that was put on the table that wasn't already on the agenda, they had to vote on it then. And so she just ended up voting in support.
And you can find Mallory's coverage of this on our website, klcc.org. And she's still updating it with as she's getting the final draft from the city.
It's a great example of that proverb, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Well, hopefully we won't. Yeah, hopefully that's not where we're going, right?
No, but I think it is an example of well-intentioned people realizing that sometimes nuances in language can really create a firestorm of reaction. I think on the surface, many people saw this split vote and wondered who could possibly vote against this resolution. And that's played out very well in social media and may continue quite for some time.
And I think, too, you know, like you pointed out, Brian, it's frustrating as reporters when people see a headline, you know, posted on Facebook and they don't actually read the story, because then they kind of often jump to conclusions. So encourage people to check out Mallory's coverage, again, at klcc.org. Thank you so much, Mallory, for joining us. I know you have to run off and continue to do your great reporting. So thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, you and I attended a media summit at OSU's Hatfield Marine Sciences Center earlier this week in Newport, and we got to hear from some really interesting scientists about their research. What were some highlights for you?
Well, yeah, it was really an enjoyable day out there in Newport. The We had about 14 journalists from across the region. We talked about ocean acidification, noise pollution and its effects on the ecosystem, plastics and its environmental hazards, and even the potential for ocean waves to generate a fairly modest amount of energy. But it was still very fascinating to talk to these professors and researchers about what they were involved in. We also got to try Dulce, which our Northwest News Network colleague Tom Bonzi just did a story on. This is the famed bacon seaweed that made headlines a few years ago.
And I would say, it did not taste at all like bacon. It tasted good, though.
Rachel.
It tasted good. It was tasty.
Yeah, it's being touted as being healthier than kale. It's been the rage in Europe for some time, especially in Ireland. But before you plan on making that Dulce lettuce and tomato sandwich, you need to note that this stringy red stuff is pretty briny and perhaps has some bacony notes on it. So I think the researchers are trying to tamper down some of the expectations. I did try it, though, and like you, I enjoyed it. One of the more controversial aspects of the day was the OSU Marine Studies building, which we toured at the end of the event. It's a $62 million project. It's going to house research labs, classrooms, and be very, very state-of-the-art. It's got a unique design element to it. It's supposed to be very resilient against earthquakes and tsunamis, and has a fortified base. The structure itself, as you and I talked about on the way back, two-thirds of it, roughly, is underground, and so a peak top of it's going to be just above the surface. It's a rooftop area, can accommodate up to 900 people with a slanted walkway that's going to let people leave the roof and near what's called Safe Haven Hill, just off of Highway 101. Here's Crystal Sanderson. She's project architect with YGH Architecture, and she's describing some of the structure's features that are the result of analysis and engineering standards.
So there is a sloped evacuation walkway that was designed per FEMA guidelines for vertical evacuation, and it includes geofoam and will have engineered fill going up at a 4-to-1 slope up over the roof of an auditorium wing, and then up to the lab wing, which is where a vertical evacuation will occur.
So yeah, the idea is that people could use this building to escape from a tsunami, and when the waters recede, they could then leave for higher ground. But Chris Goldfinger, who's an OSU geologist and well known for his research on the Cascadia subduction zone, he was not a fan of this building. He feels really concerned about this move to build in a tsunami inundation zone. He spoke about the subduction zone. He said it's been about 500 years since the last big earthquake here, and there's a 1 in 3 chance of a minimum 7.1 earthquake here. One thing he said that struck me is that we're continuing to build with a turn-of-the-century mentality, meaning the 20th century, when we should be moving cities out of subduction zones. And he's also disappointed with the Oregon legislature's repeal this session of a nearly 25-year-old law that prohibits new schools, hospitals, jails, and police and fire stations from being built in tsunami inundation zones. He said Oregon has gone from being a leader in the realm of preparedness to going backwards.
He even posted a comment to that effect on the story that I did about the OSU Marine Studies building. And he says that this essentially creates a risk that did not previously exist by putting faculty, students, and staff directly in the tsunami zone. And he wraps up that the structure was supported mainly by those directly involved with it.
My parents were part-time residents of Newport for many, many years, and they were in the inundation zone. I loved going to visit them, but I, for one, was a little bit relieved when they decided to not live at the coast part-time anymore, because there's a part, you know, I love the ocean, I love walking on the beach, but there's definitely a part of you that you're admiring the view, and then there's a little voice in the back of your head that says, I'm really, really close to the water right now if something were to happen. So
exactly.
It is, you know, and there's, you know, these cities that are beautiful are built right on the water.
I think one of the takeaways just overall from this summit was, for me, came early in the presentation from the scientist who does a lot of research on threats to ocean mammals and ocean life, and basically just saying, you know, people should be considering the ocean along with everything else when we're talking about the environment and ecology, just how important the ocean is.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're listening to the Northwest Passage on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald with Ani Katz and Brian Bull. And it's time for us to talk about something that stuck with us this week in the news.
I'll go first. There was a bison attack in Yellowstone this week that went viral. The video has since been removed from Twitter, but it's still visible on many news station sites, including the Today Show and the Washington Post. And what it does is it shows a hefty bison standing fairly calmly there by the Old Faithful geyser site, and then suddenly it charges a group of people. And as people run screaming around, it targets a 9-year-old girl from Florida, and with its head flings her into the air at least 10 feet, it looks like. And everyone is just screaming, and then the video just abruptly cuts out. The good news is that the media reports say that the girl is okay. That's all fine and good. But apparently, witnesses say that a group of about 50 people had been hovering way too close, 5 to 10 feet apart at times, and for way too long to the bison while touring the park. The message that park officials want to share is that these are wild animals that are powerful, strong, and unpredictable. In fact, in 2015, there was an advisory discouraging selfies with bison after 5 bison-related injuries. And so as a former park ranger myself, I recalled when I was working as a summer seasonal, I'd get these almost daily bulletins from the National Park Service, and almost at least once a week, you're guaranteed to hear of someone, a tourist, who was trampled, gored, or bitten by a bison because they got too close and even, in some cases, tried to put their kids on its hump. So don't do that. These aren't like Disney critters who chum up to you and sing along with you, and that's not a petting zoo out there in the wild. Besides wildlife, park officials also want tourists to not do selfies near hot springs, geysers, and the edges of canyons for reasons that they hope are way too obvious to others.
Many, many years ago, speaking of rescue dogs, actually, we were in Yellowstone in one of those famous traffic jams with our dog, and the windows were open, and bison was making its way down the road. People were being very respectful of the, you know, I mean, as respectful as you can be when you're in your car. And our lovely dog, who's a part beagle, started screaming at the bison because it was, you know, they're huge, and she didn't know what it was. So of course, immediately we like closed the windows, and the bison just very slowly with its huge, powerful head just kind of looked at our car and then kept walking. So we avoided getting our car tipped over by a bison, but it was a close call.
Wow.
They can weigh up to a ton.
They're huge animals.
Yeah. And run up to 30 miles per hour. So you figure that weight plus that velocity. It's very fortunate that the girl survived that encounter.
30 miles an hour. Oh my God. That's incredible.
Well, my takeaway this week also has to do with wildlife. I had a personal throwback to my reporting from 2007. I was at KAZU in Monterey, and I did a story about monarch butterfly tagging there. I ended up getting it onto a national show, Living on Earth. So yesterday, someone from the program contacted me because they'd like to re-air it this week as part of a show on butterflies. And so I kind of had to remember back to 12 years ago when I did this story. And it was neat, too, because they actually still have it on their website. So here's a little piece of my reporting from 2007 in Monterey, California. Pacific Grove's George Washington Park is a shady grove of trees on the edge of a quiet residential street. Here on a cool late winter morning, wildlife biologist Jessica Griffiths is reaching high into a live oak tree with a 15-foot pole with a net on the end. She's shaking the pole.
Okay, so you can see they're really cold. They're not moving very much.
The monarchs are all clustered together at the end of a branch.
Rise and shine!
So just really neat to you know, think back on work that I did back then. And, of course, monarch butterflies are still are in more peril than they were then. And scientists are concerned about, you know, their ability to survive.
Is climate change a part of that?
I think so. And I think it also has to do with loss of just territory, just human development encroaching on their supply of milkweed and wild places to feed.
Sure.
Yeah, we're all supposed to plant milkweed now, right?
Right.
Yes.
Next to our bat houses.
So obviously we know that special counsel Robert Mueller testified in front of two different House committees this week. But I do feel like that topic has been talked about a lot. So we listened. We know what happened. I hope that everybody listened to. It was very interesting to pay attention to. But in some more local news that happened, Frank Nearing, who was a reporter for KLCC for many, many years, died at the end of June. And we found out about that this week when his obituary was published. I have memories of Frank from my first time around at KLCC back in 2000. Rachel was here too. And he was just always the friendliest, loveliest man. I didn't know, I learned this from his obituary, that KLCC was actually his second career. After he retired, he went back to school at LCC and learned how to do this work, and then ended up spending many years covering all kinds of meetings for us and doing excellent reporting. And so the news that he had passed this week was very sad. He was married to his wife, Pat, for 72 years, and they have 9 kids, which is kind of amazing.
And he lived to be 100 years old.
Yes. In January, he turned 100.
One of the reasons that he actually retired from KLCC had to do with us moving to our new building here in downtown Eugene, because we left the reel-to-reel machine behind. Frank actually continued to use reel-to-reel machines to edit his tape for his stories. And you can actually listen to a story I posted at our website, klcc.org. That's an interview Claude Offenbacher did with Frank years ago. And you can actually hear him editing tape on the reel-to-reel.
Once he's read it through, he adjusts the reel-to-reel to find his starting point.
Okay, we're ready to go.
First take, if you please, at about 7. In the spring of 2004, the county's tax department applied for a grant.
The tape recording is rolling. Frank is recording.
That grant was initially denied, and an evaluation.
You can find that at our website. It's also posted on our Facebook page. But yeah, he was a true treasure of a person, and a very, you know, he had a lot of integrity as a reporter. I know folks on the county commission always talked about how he would refuse to have, you know, if they were having refreshments or anything, he would refuse to even have a cup of coffee at a event that he was covering as a reporter.
Wow.
He was before my time here, but just judging by the comments on the Facebook posting and the website, it seems like he was very highly regarded and revered by the KLCC audience.
Yeah, definitely. And the people that he covered.
Absolutely.
So,
sorry. Yeah, no.
Well, that wraps up this week's Northwest Passage podcast. Thanks to reporter Mallory Begay for joining us earlier. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm the host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.
And I'm news reporter Brian Bull.